calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on radiopower.org, whiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital, and airamericaradio.com. Welcome to our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. You can drop by our live chat room by going to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. And click on the live chat link. Dr. Yaron Brook, or Yaron, Yaron Brook is with us. Right, Yaron? Yaron? Hello?
Yeah, you there?
Hey, gotcha. Is with us. You're with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And welcome, Yaron.
Oh, it's good to be on.
Always good to have you here. Just for those listeners who may not be familiar with you or with Ayn Rand or have not heard, you know, us having these conversations before, I think that it's so important that your voice be out there, and that because Ayn Rand's writings, particularly with her book Atlas Shrugged and her writings on the virtue of selfishness, have in many ways colored, influenced, I would say very strongly influenced, modern conservative thinking. Certainly libertarians, I know you guys objectivists would say that you're not conservatives and you're not, you know, that's not what you are, but the Cato Institute and others have strongly influenced this. I think you are the thinkers behind the modern conservative movement, and I just like to highlight the your perspective, my perspective, and we'll share it with people and let them see what they have to say on this.
Sure, as I've always said, I mean, I wish that were true. I wish conservatives and even the libertarians were more influenced by Ayn Rand.
Yeah, I understand. Yesterday, the United States Senate, by a vote of 51-47, as I recall, voted against increasing the federal minimum wage from $5.15 an hour up to a little over $6 an hour over about a year and a half period. And this vote against raising the minimum wage, of course, being led by conservatives, I would guess, Yaron, that you would say not only are you opposed to the minimum wage being increased, you're opposed to a minimum wage altogether, aren't you?
You know me well. Yes, I would say that a minimum wage just generally is a violation of the individual rights of the employers. I think that the government has no role to play in the economy at all. It certainly has no role in determining wages in a free market. Employers should be left alone to negotiate with employees, and employees should try to get the best wage that they can out of their employers.
But
it's
by allowing
a market process, and we should let it work.
But by allowing a corporation to exist, by allowing people to organize together in a form of limited liability corporation,
sure,
which I know you embrace, we are creating a quasi public, you know, it's a public-private institution. It's an institution that is the creation of government. So how can you say government has no role in the marketplace and then at the same time say, but the marketplace is created by government, our currency is maintained by government,
sure,
we have courts that enforce the laws that allow contracts to be enforced. I mean, the whole thing is all about government. Wouldn't it be, I mean, here's my take on it, that if government is creating the marketplace and not the other way around, if government is making it possible for us to play the game of business, then government, being we the people, we have a right to say, okay, you're going to play the game of business. Here's the rules by which you play. And one of those rules is you have to pay people a decent wage.
Well, let's first remember that minimum wage applies not just to corporations, but it applies to mom-and-pop stores, and it applies to everybody. And therefore,
sure,
it I think, ultimately,
well, there are actually not everybody. There are quite a few exceptions to it, but your point is well taken.
It does not apply just to corporations, and therefore, what it does is, I think, it eliminates certain businesses from existence, and it has to create a certain level of unemployment. But let me go to the broader and more important point that you mentioned, and that is, no,
I'm sorry, I just, you know, the point you just made, I have to challenge, you know, before you move along, as if it's just, you know, if the minimum wage is putting more money in the pockets of wage earners,
mm-hmm,
and particularly minimum wage earners spend virtually 100% of the money they get, and that spending creates demand, How can that create unemployment? If you increase demand, particularly from the bottom up, you grow an economy. That's how we've always grown an economy.
That's just not true, because economy does not grow based on consumption. Consumption is not the driver of the economy. That is a myth that's been perpetrated since Keynes, but it's just wrong. What grows the economy, and the money had to come from somewhere in order to pay these employees. Therefore, the money is not created by paying employees.
But no, the money is created by labor. It's like Abraham Lincoln said, labor is superior to capital because it precedes capital. There was no money until somebody worked and made something.
Well, that is true. Making the something is the primary. Production is the primary, but production doesn't necessarily happen in the hands of the employees making minimum wage. Indeed, the production happens many, many stages.
How can you have production without employees?
Let me just go back to the point here, and that is, A, you don't create wealth by paying employees a salary. The wealth is created well before they get the salary. Second, let's take an extreme case. Let's set the minimum wage at $100 an hour. If you set the minimum wage at $100 an hour, you create massive unemployment all across the country. Now, if you set it at 50, you create slightly less unemployment. If you set it at 6, you're still pricing some people out of the market. That's why people like you want minimum wage, because it sets a certain threshold that some people don't produce $6 an hour worth of stuff and therefore are not employable. And it has to create a certain level of unemployment. Any price control creates distortions in the market and creates shortages. And in this case, it's going to create less jobs for people who can only create.
Well, let me just challenge those fundamental premises. First of all, yes, there are some situations where people aren't even, you know, their labor is not worth $6 an hour. And so there are exceptions for kids running Kool-Aid stands out in front, you know, lemonade stands out in front of their house and things like that. And there are, and in agriculture, frankly, I don't think there should be exemptions in agriculture, but there are exemptions to the minimum wage in agriculture. But let's say that we set the minimum wage at $100.
Yep.
You know, to take your extreme example, and it's always useful to push these things to the edges and see what happens. If you set the minimum wage at $100, what's going to happen is that that is going to define the cost of labor, and so the cost of goods are going to adjust relative to it, and what you're going to see is a decrease in the value of currency, that's all.
No, that's not true. What you would see is massive bankruptcy across the entire economy. What you would see is a depression set in on this nation.
Then why is it that
nobody would make $100 an hour?
Then why is it
nobody could afford to pay?
No, everybody would make $100 an hour, and a loaf of bread would cost $100. That's
well,
my
but
point.
Then the cost of living. No, that's not how it would adjust.
Sure, it is. That's how it always.
Most businesses would fail instantly if you raised the minimum wage to $100 an hour.
Yeah, well, and of course, nobody is proposing that. But if you go back and you look at the history of the minimum wage from its first institution in the Roosevelt administration, after, you know, 20 years earlier when it had been tried, and then the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional, and now with John Roberts on it, may be declared unconstitutional again. Who knows? But every time the minimum wage was increased over that year and the following two or three years, there actually was a lower than normal increase in the rate of inflation. In other words, it was not inflationary. And the economy picked up during those years every time the minimum wage was increased.
Well, but you can't.
You know, proving
that
Keynes was right. The consumption does drive an economy.
You can't. That's just plain not true. Consumption does not drive the economy. And you cannot make that kind of causal relationship between those statistics. The fact is
But at the very least, they refute your argument that increasing the minimum wage harms the economy.
If I set the price of bread tomorrow at $10 a loaf, certain people couldn't afford to buy bread anymore. If I set the cost of labor at 6, 7, whatever you want to make the minimum wage, certain employers cannot afford to hire employees anymore, and therefore certain people are priced out of the labor market, and you're creating a certain level of unemployment. Economic activity is not created by people being unemployed. Economic activity is created when people are employed and when you optimize the use of capital and labor. You cannot optimize the use of capital and labor when you've got the government arbitrarily setting prices of anything. It doesn't matter. Wages are just one price within the economy.
The government is arbitrarily establishing the marketplace. The government is authorizing the existence
That's the original point you made, which I completely disagree with. The marketplace comes about naturally when the government stays out of it. All the government has to do is respect contracts and defined property rights. That's it. And liability, limited liability, was not a government creation. It was a market creation that then the government recognized. It was a market creation in Britain in the 17th
it was
century.
It was a creation of feudalism.
Government then recognized and provided legal protection.
Just it was
like
a creation
the
of
government
feudalism.
Protects, just like the government protects partnerships, it protects the mom and pop store, it protects property rights. This is one form of property rights that the government protects, and that's all the government should do within the economic context. It should protect our rights to contract in any way that we want. And if I want you to pay you $2 an hour and you're willing to take $2 an hour, it's nobody else's business. Nobody
but,
should
but
have a right,
a,
even
a
majority
a
should have a right to dictate
no,
how much.
Come on, Yaron, don't filibuster me here.
Yep.
There is a fundamental disparity in power between the person who has the ability to write the paycheck and the person who has no alternative but to take the job in an environment where there are more people looking for jobs than there are jobs.
But the reason there are more people looking for jobs than there are jobs is because of government intervention. In a truly free market, there are many more jobs than people looking for those jobs.
But
and
if you look at the truly free markets, you never find a middle class. If you look at truly free markets, what you find is a whole lot of terrified working poor. And, I mean, keep in mind, in the United States right now, there's 30 million people. A third of the workforce are the working poor.
The middle class is created by a free market and by capitalism. Indeed, the middle class was created in the 19th century when you didn't have minimum wage.
Okay.
That's when the middle class came into being.
Okay, Yaron Brook, thanks so much for being with us.
Always fun.
AYNRAND.org, the website. Yaron Brook. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 17 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Start me up. Start me up.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number 866-440-8466. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. It's the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. I want to share with you, I just want to stay on this topic for a little while here about the minimum wage. Why do we have a minimum wage? You've heard Yaron Brook, the Ayn Rand folks, you know, the conservative. Again, you know, he wouldn't call himself a conservative, but the conservative worldview on this that minimum wage, what? The government involving itself in the marketplace? We can't have that. But really, here's my take on this. The fundamental issue is, I mean, the real fundamental issue is that the worker-employee relationship in the marketplace, by and large, is a power relationship. And if corporations and employers can legally band together and form powerful entities like businesses and trade associations, then employees should be able to band together and form, for example, trade unions. And in those situations where employees cannot band together, employees can band together in the form of we the people saying, hey, you with the employers want to run a business here, you want to employ people, there are certain terms under which you're going to have to do it. And this, by the way, is not a new idea. Here is the Republican president of the United States. The Republican president of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, talking about a living wage. He was the first to introduce the phrase living wage.
We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
So he says, you know, we stand for a living wage and they're subnormal if you can't make a living. Now, what does that mean? Well, he says it varies from place to place.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions.
But there are certain components of it that are undisputable.
But must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
And what is a normal standard of living? Teddy Roosevelt, Republican President of the United States. This is a recording, by the way, made personally by Thomas Edison.
A standard high enough to make morality possible.
Okay, so you don't have to steal to eat.
To provide for education and recreation.
To provide for education and recreation. You put your kids through school, you can take vacations.
Care for immature members of the family.
You can raise your children, buy them clothes, put them through school.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
Ah, so you have health care, so if you get sick, it doesn't wipe you out financially.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age. In other words, so you can retire. Now, there were people back in 1906, 1907, in the early 1900s when Teddy Roosevelt was president, and then later in 1912, somewhere around there when he ran again for president on the Bull Moose Party, who called themselves conservatives. And they said Teddy Roosevelt was being a liberal, even though he was a Republican. And he said, okay, you know, if that's who you think you are, well, let me actually share with you Teddy Roosevelt's thoughts on conservatives. Just a few short clips.
I prefer to work with moderate, with rational conservatives, provided only that they do in good faith strive forward toward the light. But when they halt and turn their backs to the light, sit with the scorners on the seats of reaction, then I must part company with them.
And who are these conservatives? See, there's been this historic understanding of who conservatives really are in this country. That, again, this is a recording from 1912. Who the conservatives really are in the United States.
But the beneficiaries of privilege, the Bourbon reactionaries, the short-sighted ultra-conservatives turned down to a go. And then found that instead of him, they had obtained Robespierre.
Yeah, Robespierre. So he's making this parallel with the French Revolution. In other words, the conservatives are those who are, yeah, they're sitting there in the places of power and privilege and saying, yeah, we've got all the money, we'll just take it. You know, everything's fine, we'll just take it.
May our ultra-conservatives remember that the rule of the Bourbons brought on the Revolution.
Yes, and may they remember that it was the rule of the Bourbons that brought on the French Revolution. You got to be careful. Let them eat cake is not a good slogan. But even beyond the issue of revolution, there's an issue of fairness here with the minimum wage. And it was the right thing to do. And Congress decided, the United States Senate decided yesterday, the Republicans in the United States Senate, 51-47, pretty much a party line vote. The Republicans in the United States Senate said the average working person in America, 30 million people in the United States working full time and living in poverty, said to the average working American, tough luck. Sorry, you're not part of our constituency. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's just
and welcome back. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. But about 26 before, 25 and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. The place where being progressive never felt so good. Going to go to your phone calls in just a second. I just can't help myself. Teddy Roosevelt, it was so cool, and I just have to share with you a little bit more of Teddy Roosevelt. Because, see, what people don't realize, particularly people who haven't been, you know, observing politics for decades, is that we used to have in this country, I mean, for hundreds of years, we had in this country, rational discussions about politics and the big issues, I mean, the real big issues about what is the role of government and what is the appropriate role of the marketplace and that sort of thing, were simply discussed out loud. And so here we are, a Republican president of the United States. Here's Teddy Roosevelt a little later on in his career taking on Woodrow Wilson, where Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat, who was taking the conservative position. He's the one who got us into World War I, you'll remember, and which I still don't understand. And in any case, Woodrow Wilson saying, like Yaron Brooks said, that liberty is less government. And Teddy Roosevelt saying, no, wait a minute, government is us. That's true if you want feudalism. That's true if you want economic slavery. Yes, liberty for the bosses is what Teddy Roosevelt. Well, I'll let Teddy Roosevelt tell you in his own words.
Mr. Wilson and myself is fundamental. The other day, in a speech at Sioux Falls, Mr. Wilson stated his position when he said that the history of government the history of liberty was the history of the limitation of governmental power.
Now, there he is quoting Woodrow Wilson. You know, the history of liberty is the history of the limitation of government power. And then Roosevelt takes him on.
This is true as an academic statement of history in the past. It is not true as a statement affecting the present. It is true of the history of medieval Europe.
It's the true of the history of medieval Europe. And this is my point.
It is not true of the history of 20th century America. In the days when all governmental power existed exclusively in the king or in the baronage, and when the people had no shred of that power in their own hands, then it undoubtedly was true that the history of liberty was the history of the limitation of the governmental power of the outsiders who possessed that power. But today, the people have, actually or potentially, the entire governmental power.
There you go. In other words, that's the whole idea of America is government of, by, and for we the people. And then Roosevelt comes out. This is actually a little earlier during his presidency. Another recording made by Thomas Edison where Teddy Roosevelt comes out and says, you know, the big bosses of industry are in it with the big bosses in politics, whether they're Democratic or Republican. Doesn't matter. It's all about the big bosses, and that's what we've got to take back. Here, Teddy Roosevelt on the big bosses.
The big bosses of the political field, the beneficiaries of privilege in the field of industry, the men who represent that sinister alliance between crooked politics and crooked business.
Isn't that great? That sinister alliance between crooked business and crooked politics. Now, he's talking about... It's a Tom DeLay moment. I mean, this is a Tom DeLay moment back in the first years of the 20th century, like in 1906 or something like that. I don't have the exact year on this recording, but it was made when he was president. And here he is saying, he's talking about corrupt politicians and how the reason they're corrupted is because they're in it with the big corporate bosses. He continues.
Just done more than anything else for the corruption of American life. Are united as one man against the genuine rule of the people themselves.
The big bosses and the corrupt politicians are united as one man against the people themselves. Well,
the privileged classes, the representatives of special privilege, of special interest, can always make terms with a boss.
They can always make terms with the bosses.
Of bosses.
With the boss of bosses.
They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Republican Party.
Yeah.
They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
But they can't make terms with the people.
Uh-oh.
They can't make terms with the men who honestly and genuinely represent the popular will.
They can't make terms with the people who honestly and genuinely represent the popular will. They can't make terms with the people. Teddy Roosevelt was actually a progressive, a Republican progressive. Progressives challenge the institutions of power. Liberals merely want to use government to be a good force, which is a fine thing. Most progressives are also liberals. But just one last thought of Teddy Roosevelt's on conservatives.
Friends, our task as Americans is to strive for social and industrial justice achieved through the genuine rule of the people.
Through the rule of the people.
In our hearts, we must have this lofty purpose and we must strive for it in all earnestness and sincerity, or our work will come to nothing.
Yeah, or our work will come to nothing. So, anyhow, enough of Teddy Roosevelt. Greg in Berea, is it Berea, Kentucky, or Berea, Kentucky, Greg?
Berea.
Berea. Ah.
Yes, sir.
Very well. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program. What's up?
Thank you, Tom. How are you doing today? Just a couple quick points I wanted to make on your guest world, according to Greg, anyway. When he says optimize capital, you know, by not having a minimum wage that
right.
then go to the workers, when has that ever happened?
There you go.
And then when he's I think the ultimate concern here is, well, there's no way we can compete against the 10-cent an hour labor we can get overseas, so let's just keep no minimum wage here, so then it's not that big a deal.
Well, and that's where this logic goes, and that's why really you have to have, if you're going to have minimum wage laws in a country, if you're going to establish a middle class, and I challenge anybody to disprove me on this. There has never in history been a middle class without either organized labor. It used to be called the guild system, the old, you know, unions like the Masons, you know, and it was a very small middle class at that time. There has never been a middle class without either unions or governmental intervention, because the laissez-faire, pure, raw capitalist marketplace, naked capitalism, will a whole lot of terrified poor workers and a very small number of very wealthy people. And so what we have done in the United States, and what all the European countries have done, particularly those who the liberals, you know, Roosevelt and Truman helped set up after World War II, is we have said, okay, we're going to have regulated capitalism. We're going to have, you know, and it's going to be regulated in a democracy. We the people are going to help make some of the decisions about what kind of world we want to live in. Greg, thank you very much for the call and for your comment. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Tom in Traverse City, Michigan. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Hey, I commend you for everything you're saying. You're a voice of reason and intelligence.
Thank you.
For that gentleman who was on earlier,
Yaron Brook.
Yeah, yes. Who thinks that the 19th century was some golden age for the middle class?
Well, there essentially was no middle class in the 19th century. The average wage in the year 1900, when Teddy Roosevelt became president, in today's dollars was $8,900, annual wage in the United States.
Well, I mean, and they had no child labor laws.
That's right.
And they could work 7 days a week. I mean, there was nothing. The workers had nothing.
That's right. And people who tried to organize routinely got murdered.
Absolutely. I've been afraid of it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Tom. You're breaking up. I gotta move along because your phone is breaking up. Joe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, Tom. You got a great program, and I like the Roosevelt sequences.
Well, thank you. I hope they were. You could hear them on that end.
I heard them.
They're a little rough, you know.
Well, you know what? I'm going to tell you something. I was in the Teamsters Union, and I was in the Electrical Union. I was a steward, and buddy, we fought hand and foot every day. You just don't go to the employer and say, would you please give me a little more money? I fought every day with them bosses.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. What it's really all about is power. And that's the thing that conservatives never want to address,
because
they don't want to admit it, that really what it's about is power, the power of organized capital versus the lack of power of disorganized labor, or the power of organized labor. And they don't want the power of organized labor, or they don't want the power of labor with the protection of government.
And that guest of yours, now, when I called you, the guy that took my call, he says, now, keep it clean.
Well, that's just, you know, we want to stay on the air.
Because
there's these laws.
I told him, I don't want to ever see that Yaron Brook.
Yeah.
Because I would tell him something. I think it something would happen.
Okay. Joe, thanks a lot.
Bro.
And thank you for restraining yourself. I appreciate it. Bonnie in Pittsburgh. We have 1 minute, Bonnie. What's on your mind today?
Well, the one caller stole my thunder about the 19th century. I'd have to say that the greatest rise of the middle class was after World War II. When there were strong labor unions, which brought about all the benefits that are being rolled back today.
Which
reminds me, you were discussing about Greenspan and Reagan yesterday, and I thought Paul Volcker was the head of the Reserve. Was he an objectivist?
No, Volcker wasn't quite all that bad, and I'm not sure what year the transition was, but if you read Ravi Batra's book, I think, you know, I'm not sure what year Greenspan came in, but it was Greenspan who advised Reagan in either 82 or 83, and he may not have been the head of the Fed at the time, but he was the guy who advised Reagan to start borrowing from Social Security. Ravi Batra has nailed him. I mean, the book is called Greenspan's Fraud. Thank you very much, Bonnie. Great to hear from you. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. It's 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. And Willie in Savannah, Georgia on the line. Hey, Willie, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I was listening to your interview with your guest there, and I'm really confused as far as the double talk. He was saying that consumption does not fuel an economy, but I know on the news I hear that it was the consumers who are helping keep our economy going.
Yeah, I see. What I'm saying is if people don't buy things, then you don't have an economy. And what he's saying is if you don't have big bosses making businesses, then you don't have an economy.
Oh, okay. Well, he'd need to remember Henry Ford.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, exactly. Because, Henry Ford, right, raising people's wages to $5 a day so that they could afford to buy the cars that they were making.
Exactly. I mean, if you don't pay us enough to buy your product, then all these bankruptcies that he says is going to happen if you do raise our wages, they're happening anyway. He needs
there
to
you
read
go.
The paper.
There you go. Well said, Willie. Really well said. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Daniel in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for your patience with your guests. You do far better, than I think, than most people would when people put out these ideas. I just find this whole thing basically faith-based economics, just like a lot of the stuff they do. The reality of the thing is, as long as there's big government, big business, there has to be big government to counterbalance it. And the fact is that government's run by us, like you said, and big business is not. So that's the only power we have. And
That's the unique thing about a democracy, is that the government is us. Every time you hear Sean Hannity or one of these other bozos out there going, government bad, they're talking about us.
Right. Yeah, and these people, they really can't see the real world, and particularly that thing he said about there's the middle class came about, you know, when there was no minimum wage and no unions, and I mean, a sixth grade history class can straighten that out for him.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank
well,
you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Daniel. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, Kevin in Reston, Virginia. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, it's Kevin. I just want to point out, how would he feel? Okay, if he believes minimum wage, how about eliminating his salary down
yeah.
to minimum wage?
Well, you know, usually
you know,
people
all four.
Usually people who are advocating the elimination of the minimum wage are not people who are working at the minimum wage, although to be fair to Yaron Brook, first of all, I really appreciate the fact that he's willing to come on this program over and over again. You know, we try to have these guys on periodically. I try to get conservatives on this program. I'd like to have, you know, somebody on every single day, because I think it's so important that people understand their talking points, their worldview, and my talking points and my worldview are ours, you know, the historic American worldview. And very few conservatives will come on this program. It is almost impossible for us to get them to come on. And Yaron will come on this program, and he'll be perfectly honest. He doesn't play, you know, the nonsense political games, and you know, like the Republicans do, where they're just saying, well, you know, we don't want to hurt the economy, blah, blah, blah. But they really do have an ideology. This isn't just in a vacuum. And the ideology is not a dumb one. It's the ideology, I would say, I'm not putting words in his mouth, it's the ideology of aristocracy. It's the ideology of feudalism, of, you know, rule by the rich.
Yeah. And also I wanted to point out, hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, I also wanted to point out that even in Nazi Germany, part of the reason why the German population was so behind Hitler is because even Hitler knew you had to have a viable middle and working class.
As oh, yeah.
twisted as he was, he knew that.
Sure, and he used the workers. He played them like violins. I mean,
yeah.
he's, you know, in the early
yeah.
years, and he made the economy work, and he made the roads work, and he made the trains run on time, and all that kind of stuff. And everybody thought he's our guy. And boy, did they get suckered. But that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
Kevin, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing
okay.
that out. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you, Patricia in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Patricia.
Hi there. I would like to say that, you know, most of the truck drivers out here in this country are not covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. And that means that corrupt companies can take advantage of drivers. And, you know, if, for instance, they decide not to pay a driver, then that driver has nobody to protect them, no agency to go to file a grievance.
I know, it's a terrible thing, and this is brought to you courtesy of Ronald Reagan, if my recollection is correct.
You know, I'm afraid I don't know the history of it all that well,
yeah.
except that it began with the deregulation.
Right. Yeah, and that was Reagan's mantra, is let's deregulate everything, and the mergers and acquisition mania, let's deregulate trucking, let's deregulate this, that, and the other thing. You know, they deregulated the airline industry in 80, must have been around 82, 80, well, it might have been a little before that. I was actually in that industry in 83. Yeah, so I think trucking, actually, you know, some of it might have come from Jimmy Carter. I'm not sure, frankly, but
there's a lot of unpaid labor involved in this work.
Yep.
You know, and you know, of course, we have to stay out on the road for X number of days at a time. There's a lot of corruption in various ways in this industry.
Yeah, and it's not a good thing. Patricia, thank you very much for sharing your perspective with us. I do appreciate it. Jerry in Greenville, Michigan on the line. Hey, Jerry.
Yes, you talked about the Reagan administration and some of the books about it, but you've never mentioned a book by Kevin Phillips called The Politics of Rich and Poor, Wealth and the American Electorate in the Reagan Aftermath. Kevin Phillips is a fantastic guy. You should have him as a guest.
Oh, yeah, his book, Wealth and Democracy, is brilliant.
Yes, right, and he also wrote Arrogant Capitalism and the Bush Dynasty.
Yeah. Yeah, Kevin Phillips is, and lest people forget, Kevin Phillips is the guy who back in the 70s wrote The Emerging Republican Majority.
Right, he was a top advisor to Nixon.
Right, and
Nixon
he
used the book as a blueprint, except he added a little racism and used the code words law and order.
That's right, and the Southern Strategy, which hadn't been part of Phillips' lexicon. But Kevin Phillips was one of those ethical conservatives way back when, and then the conservatives kind of, you know, went around the bend. And Kevin Phillips is still writing about, you know, the wealth and politics. If, you're absolutely right. People should be reading Kevin Phillips' work.
Yeah, he'd make a great guest. He appears once in a while on NPR.
I agree. We'll try and track him down.
All right.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Thank you so much. Truth in Broadcasting, the pill that will help you escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. You're going to take the blue pill or the red pill? I know it's not the movie. You know, that was, what, the blue and green? Anyhow, I'll go for the blue pill.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, and every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends, to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. The radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the Tom Hartman radio program. Broadcasting live from coast to coast. Kevin Shelley is with us, the former Secretary of State of the state of California. Kevin Shelley, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
I am so pleased to have you on. It's an honor to have you on, in fact, sir. You were the first Secretary of State in the United States, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, to require a voter-verified paper trail for electronic voting machines. Is that?
That's correct. We did that requirement in the fall of 2003.
So tell us what was... Let me get a sentence out here. What is the issue with regard to paper trails and electronic voting machines that would cause Republicans, conservatives, or anybody for that matter? I mean, we can even just keep this from being a partisan thing, that would cause anybody to say, no, you know, it's fine if you get a receipt on your Diebold machine at the bank. It's fine if you get a receipt on your Diebold machine when you buy a ticket for a sporting event, but you don't really need one for your vote. Why would anybody say that?
Well, you know, it's beyond me why they would, particularly Diebold, who makes most of the ATM machines, why it would be appropriate in that instance and not appropriate with an electronic voting machine is ridiculous. You know, quite frankly, the right to vote is the most fundamental representation of our democracy, and every voter has to have the confidence that their vote will be counted as it was cast. And without a paper trail that could be an actual record to be used in the case of a recount, we never have the confidence that the electronic voting machines accurately record our vote.
So now you're talking about going beyond a receipt, because if we have a paper trail that can be used for an audit, that's more than just a receipt. That is actually a paper ballot, essentially.
Yeah, what you want is to have a paper trail that's kept within the machine that can be used as the actual record or the vote of record, so to speak. So
by in the machine, you don't mean you said that's kept in the machine. You mean that's physically kept.
It's physically kept in the machine, a paper record of each and every vote. Without that, there's no way of knowing the extent to which the electronic voting machines can be manipulated. A malicious code can be placed within them. A virus occurs. And we've had high school classes change votes. So
really?
Clearly, yes. So
in clearly, California, you had a high school class hack a machine?
There was a professor a couple of years ago who had his class as a class project hack into a machine, and they were successful. So clearly we need to have these protections. And why anyone would be opposed to it is never somehow I've never understood that.
So what happened in California? I mean, how did you bring this about? What sort of opposition did you face?
We faced a tremendous opposition from several quarters. One, the vendors themselves viewed it as an unnecessary requirement, and frankly, they just were dead wrong. Two, a number of the
election officials... May I stop you right there for just a second and just get a little more information about that, if I may?
One vendor in particular, Diebold, actually outright lied to us in California in terms of what vending machines they were, or what electronic voting machines they were getting approved by the federal government. And so we actually banned Diebold or one of their pieces of equipment from doing business in California. It was a very extreme step, but it was a necessary one.
But Kevin Shelley, it seems to me that if I was a voting machine company and I'm selling my equipment to you and you're the state of California, you're representing the state, that I would be looking for ways to add value to my machine so I can raise the price so I can make more profit. I mean, if I can add a printer to my machine that costs me $110 and charge you $150, which is, you know, I mean, that's the free market, I can make an extra $40 on my machine. Why would a voting machine company ever say, no, we don't want to add something to our machine?
Well, I mean, you're asking the question to which there is no answer because it defies logic. I think more of the vendors now understand that it's an expectation on the part of the public that there be these paper trails. You know, as
right.
Legislation moving through the Congress, many states now have this requirement. We were the first in California, but many other states have followed suit. And so I think now the vendors get it, but they certainly didn't get it initially.
Okay, so I interrupted you. You were going through a list. I'm sorry.
Well, I was also going to say that a number of the election officials themselves, activists need to understand that there is an administrative burden to these various requirements on the part of election officials. But even more important, election officials, and I was one of them, need to understand that, you know, fundamentally, in the final analysis, it's not about them, and it's not about their administrative burden. It's about the voter and ensuring that the voter has the confidence that his or her vote will be accurately counted, that it's secure, that the vote's accessible. And I think that's what it's all about. And some election officials, I think, unfortunately, because it is an additional administrative burden, lose sight of that.
Yeah. We're speaking with Kevin Shelley, the former Secretary of State of California, the first Secretary of State to require a voter-verified paper trail for electronic voting machines. Mr. Shelley, what is the future of electronic voting and auditable paper trails in California, and what do you think the future is going to be across the United States?
Well, I think it's just going to be a basic requirement to have a paper trail. I expect that legislation to ultimately pass in Congress. It's certainly been recommended by a recent national commission, the Carter-Baker Commission. So I have confidence that that will be the eventual end result. In terms of electronic voting, I think, frankly, those machines were brought out before they were ready. Fundamentally, eventually, they do provide greater accessibility for the disabled community, for non-English-speaking voters, so there's a place for them, but there's never a place for them until they're ready, and they were brought out too soon.
What about the idea of open-source software? My concern, frankly,
we required in California, one of the requirements we placed as a security measure was that the source code be turned over to us, the election officials, so we could review it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is an important component. Whether or not eventually it's a completely open source code and that's placed on the web and accessible to the public, that's probably going to be some time till the vendors are open to that.
Well, the problem is that as long as
there should be a requirement for it, though, quite candidly.
Yeah, I mean, as long as the source code is proprietary, number one, there's always the opportunity for mischief, and number two, and they can claim trade secrets and things, and number two, you have the an enhanced potential for profit on the part of the voting machine company. So it's, they have a profit motive for keeping the source code proprietary, but I think we, the people, have a, you know, it's like open source stuff tends to be far more bulletproof because so many people are jumping up and down and trying to break it. Look at Linux.
Right. Well, I mean, clearly the whole election process should be subject to, you know, the light of day, sunshine. There was recently an instance in, I think it was one of the counties in California, where an activist was arrested because he simply requested reviewing the vote count tabulation process for the electronic voting machines, which, you know, under the law he has a right to do. So I think these kind of changes where the election officials become more comfortable with the absolute requirement and importance and key component of sunshine is just something they have to get more comfortable with.
Kevin Shelley, do you think that poorly done requirements for paper trails, basically that just generate like a receipt kind of thing rather than an actual ballot, that they may cause voters to have misplaced confidence in these machines and might be a dangerous thing?
Well, let's be clear in terms of the receipt. No one is suggesting that the voter walk away with a record of how he or she voted. What we're suggesting is that there be a paper trail in the machine that be an accurate record of their vote that the voter can view at the time he or she votes. But frankly, to walk away with a receipt with how you voted would lend itself to all kinds of talk about exit poll tactics and intimidation.
Sure.
We're not suggesting that. So I think doing the paper trail the right way will promote the confidence of the voter.
And that would be more than simply having the machine just print a line on a printout or something like that?
No, the voter has to see their vote.
Their ballot,
behind
basically.
Their ballot, behind a transparent window, as it were, an actual piece of paper that they can confirm so that their electronic vote is accurately recorded. And unless they can view that paper at the time they're recording their vote electronically, I don't think they will have the confidence, number one. Number two, I also think you have to have that paper in the event of a recount. That's got to be the actual official record of the vote, not the machine, because the machine can always be manipulated.
Sure. So is in 2006, is it going to be a safe, clean election in California?
Well, I certainly would hope so. You know, I was proud of the work we did in California, and I am equally pleased that a number of states are following suit, but there's a lot more to be done.
Yeah. And in Rush Holt's bill, do you think that that's a good starting point?
I think Rush Holt's bill is an outstanding bill. I have great respect for what he's doing, and I think the fact that more and more co-sponsors are coming on board is an indication of it's just a train out of the station. I hope everyone climbs on board.
But again, the Republicans are trying to bottle it up in Congress.
They've been trying to bottle it up for some time, and I hope that changes.
And in California, very quick, we have about a half a minute left. Is Arnold Schwarzenegger taking a position on this?
Well, he recently signed a bill that ensured that the paper trail itself was the official record of the vote. So we were very pleased about that. And so hopefully we're moving in the right direction.
Good. Well, congratulations, sir, for the great work you did in the state of California. Former Attorney General Secretary of State, for the state of California, Kevin Shelley. Thanks so much for being with us today, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm proud to be here.
Thank you. Good talking to you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone in the People's Republic of the United States of America. Actually broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. Our Washington bureau chief on the line. Hey, Alan, you feeling better?
Hey, well, I'll tell you, I don't know where to start because there's so much. Let's say that the House passed a bill to protect the firearms industry today from lawsuits by crime victims, 283 to 144. How do you like that?
Wow.
That was this morning.
Well, the firearms industry has a lot of money to pass out.
Not as much as the bankruptcy industry had.
Yeah.
And my friend Jerry Nadler said to me that he'd never seen so much money go around Capitol Hill as with the bankruptcy bill.
Well, you got a whole lot of banks who are probably looking at the same economic tea leaves I am and are going, uh-oh.
A couple other interesting things today. One, the Government Accountability Office issued a report today saying the Army National Guard units are short of equipment at home because they had been told to leave much of it behind in Iraq for replacement troops. And apparently, they said the Guard units had left more than 64,000 pieces of equipment worth more than $1.2 billion, and that the Army can't account for more than half the equipment, and also that this really wreaked havoc with Hurricane Katrina because quantities of critical equipment such as satellite communications equipment, radio, trucks, helicopters, night vision goggles, etc., were deployed to Iraq.
Right, electrical generators and amphibious vehicles as well.
So pretty amazing on that front. Also today, there are a bunch of these conservative Club for Growth and all those folks are going to be joining to call for reduction in federal spending. But this afternoon, there is going to be a conference call from the Democratic Rural Working Group to talk about how the Republicans' plans are really going to be hurting urban, I mean, sorry, not urban, non-urban and rural people. And if you can believe it, I mean, when I worked in the mental health industry, there was something I'm sure you're familiar with, the term called reframing.
Sure.
Well, when Bush got up in the Rose Garden this morning and talked about the fact that the reason that he thinks Harriet Myers is so good is because she had never been a judge and she thought it made a lot of sense to bring a fresh outlook of somebody who's been a successful attorney, I mean, that I've never even, that's even off the family therapy books.
Well, yeah, it is. That is a pretty good attempt at reframing. Although the reality, and I'm sure you know this, Ellen, is that there have been a number of judges, justices on the United States Supreme Court who were never judges. I believe
but
Earl Warren is one of them.
Trial experience.
Yeah.
And her, you know, questionnaire, which of course she's going to have to redo, but on her questionnaire, although Bush said today in the Rose Garden that it shows her judicial philosophy, well, I read the whole thing, even though I only have one eye at this point, and it didn't make, I didn't see any of her judicial philosophy except that she was trying to obfuscate any ideas that she possibly ever had. But anyhow, he said in the Rose Garden again today that she's been a successful attorney. Well, that's true, except that other people who have not been judges have had trial experience, and in her case law she has apparently only had 4 or 5 cases ever go to trial her entire career, and she's in her 60s.
Wow. I wonder how many of them she won.
Well, I mean, what she was one of those kind of lawyers that, you know, threatened a suit and then, of course, settled at the, you know, before it ever went to trial. Only 4 or 5 cases going to trial. I mean, frankly, people often graduating from law school in the law clinics have had more experience with that.
Yeah, I know you have some familiarity. Isn't your brother an attorney?
Both of them.
Both? Oh, two of your brothers. Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah. And which brings me, by the way, speaking of your brothers, Michael and his lawsuit with against Donald Rumsfeld and all that stuff in Germany.
The German lawsuit, yeah.
Yeah, I saw his name on a news release a couple of days ago. I don't remember the details of it. What's he up to right now?
Well, I mean, the Rumsfeld case, of course, the Germans tried to sort of knock it out because Rumsfeld was supposed to come over and visit, and he in fact did, and so the Germans sort of back-ended it, kind of like they did to Sharon in that Belgium case, remember, a few years
sure.
ago? Well, that's happening, and of course now there's other things going on in Guantanamo with a hunger strike, and of course as these papers were released, I believe yesterday, on the hunger strike, we're finding even more just terrible things going on, huge tubes without any kind of anesthesia being shoved down people's noses. I mean, it's too gross to talk about on the radio.
Force-feeding people, basically, by a tube through the nose.
But in a painful way. When you put a gastrocnemial tube down somebody's nose, usually you use some kind of way so that it is not so painful.
Yeah, first they put an anesthetic in there
right.
to numb the whole area up, and then they lubricate the tube pretty well. You're saying they're not doing either?
Apparently, not only did they not do it, that they used a huge NG tube that was, you know, larger than they normally use. I mean, what's coming out
they're punishing
about
them.
How they're, quote, rescuing these guys is scary.
Wow. Wow. And this, and we still, I mean, America used to be the shining beacon to the world. You know, we want the world to say, this is how you should do it. This is just tragic news. Ellen Ratner, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, our Washington Bureau Chief. Great, always great talking to you, Ellen. I hope your eye is getting better quickly. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain, right here.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
My bills are all due, and the babies need shoes, but I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter a pound, and I'm busted.
Welcome back, my friends.
I got a cow that went dry, and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The county will haul my belongings away. I'm busted.
Yeah, that's the fate that George W. would have for all of us, it seems. Welcome back, Talk Radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con and conservative. Our program brought to you by MotorSilk, 1-866-LESS-FUEL, evergreenamerica.com, their website. And I've got a couple of real ironies I want to share with you, but first we'll let's hear from Keith in Seattle, Washington. 1-866, by the way, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I want to get back to touchscreen voting. This idea of a paper trail is meaningless. As you know, your vote isn't counted on the computer you vote on. It goes back to a central computer, and that's where the cheating can take place.
Yeah, and in fact, it was the central tabulators that Howard Dean hacked on Topic A with Tina Brown. And, you know, that is an important point. However,
isn't it the critical point?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Even if you don't have, I mean, right now, for example, in Vermont, where I used to live, people vote on, in many of the smaller towns, you know, maybe as much as a third of the state votes on a paper ballot that's counted by the local clerk who sits there at a table and counts it and marks it off on a piece of paper. And then, in the end of the evening, they call up the local county or district or however it's organized and say, we have 212 votes for Gore and 316 vote for Bush or, you know, whatever, and they give the vote. That person who's receiving that phone call is putting it into a computer. I mean, they've been doing that for a long, long time. So even if you have paper voting, you're still going to have central tabulators. What do you do?
Well, you've got to make sure the source code is open and it's really been inspected, but I just don't trust this. I think we're drunk on computers, and as if it's the end all to everything. And I think we need to be more careful with this and just stop this idea that we have to have computers do everything with the voting.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Keith. And in fact, I lived in Germany back in the 80s, and in Germany they vote entirely on paper. It takes a couple of days to count the vote, but everybody knows who won by the time, you know, within minutes of the time the polls close because of exit polls. And but here, this is the thing that I love to play this for Republicans. This is for all the Republicans listening who are opposed to Rush Holt's bill. The thing you need to know is that Howard Dean knows how to hack voting machines. I'm telling you, you know, you get some Republican and you say, hey, did you know that the head of the Democratic National Committee knows how to hack a voting machine?
Dev sat me down, and in a few short seconds, I was amazed at what I could do.
This is Howard Dean with Bev Harris on Topic A with Tina Brown, national CNBC, national television, live.
All right, Bev, show me how to do this.
Well, what we have here is the central tabulator computer. Now, in a voting system, you have all these different voting machines at all the different polling places. Sometimes, as in a county like mine, there's 1,000 polling places in one county. All those machines feed into the one machine so it can add up all the votes. So, of course, if you were going to do something you shouldn't to a voting machine, would it be more convenient to do it to the 4,000 machines or to just come in here to one machine and deal with all of them at once?
This is the point that I believe it was Kevin, our caller, just made.
What surprises people is the central tabulator is just a PC. It's like you and I use. It uses Windows. It's just a regular computer.
So anybody who can hack into a PC can hack into the central tabulator.
The GEMS program is the program that is the central tabulator program. And I'm going to put in a password here.
This is the Diebold.
This is the official program that the county supervisor sees.
Diebold program?
Yes, this is a Diebold central tabulation program.
Okay.
And then go to election summary report. And it's kind of we're in spin for a minute while it adds up all the votes from all the different precincts. And I can see here Howard Dean has 1,000 votes. And Lex Luthor has 500. So you're beating Lex Luthor and we're...
2-1.
Yes. And Tiger Woods, unfortunately, doesn't have any votes yet.
All right.
All right, let's close this out. I was just showing you a way to go in and look at votes, which, of course, you can't tamper with. Go to the Start menu, and I'm going to show you something tricky.
Uh-oh.
And I want you to go to My Computer and just click that.
Here it comes.
And you're going to see some come up. Go to Local Disk C. Go to GEMS, which is the name of the Diebold program. You're going to go to Local DB, which stands for Local Database. That's where they keep the votes. And by the way, this has been out on the Internet for ages now. Go to Central Tabulator Votes, which is the database we just looked at, and then go to the sum of the candidates, which is that table. You see we have 800 votes here for you and 400 for Lex Luthor. Let's just flip those. We'll make that 400, and we'll give 100 votes to Tiger. Let's just see what happened here. We'll go back into GEMS the legitimate way. You're the county supervisor. You're checking on the progress of your election. And as you can see now, Howard Dean only has 500 votes. Lex Luthor has 900, and Tiger Woods has 100 votes. Mm. We just edited an election. It took us 90 seconds.
We just edited an election. It took us 90 seconds. Howard Dean hacking a Diebold machine on national television. I'm telling you, you get near a Republican and you say, hey, did you know that Howard Dean is the only politician in America who's ever actually hacked a Diebold voting machine live on national television? He did it right in front of America and everybody, and he's the chairman of the Democratic National Party. And their eyes get really wide and they go, the Democrats know how to hack voting machines? Yes! Not only do the Democrats know how to do it, they're proud of it. Look at that. I mean, they're proud of it. Oh, my God, we've got to do something about these voting machines. So your mission, my friend, your mission is to get out there and tell as many Republicans as you can, Howard Dean knows how to hack voting machines. Psst, pass it along. That will produce a revolution. Then you will see Denny Hastert saying, hey, that Rush Holt bill, we got to get that thing out of committee. I don't know why we've had that thing bottled up for 3 years. I can't figure it out. We got to get that out right away. Dave in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Tom, your interview with Kevin Shelley went by a bit too quickly for me. This has been an issue for me for a long time.
Kevin's a good guy.
I think that it is perfectly reasonable to leap to draw the logical conclusion that if one party is insisting on, in every way they can, having unverifiable voting machines, then it is the intent of that party to use them to defraud us. There was so many...
Did you see, by the way, Dave, the movie that Nancy Pelosi's daughter put together? Was it an Alexandria Pelosi, I believe her name is, where she interviewed Peter King, Congressman Peter King of New York? And he was drunk. It was at a party on Election Day 2004. He was plastered. And she's got the camera on him. It's one of these little handheld, home movie cameras, home video cameras. And he says, well, the election's all over now. It's nothing but the counting, and we'll take care of that, or something, words to that effect. And I saw that, and it just gave me a chill. He was just so smug. So, we've got that under control. Don't you worry.
Yeah, and they still got those things, and they still are blocking us from having them verified. But, in so many little precincts that only had a couple hundred registered voters, mostly Democrats, that precinct could deliver 5,000 or 6,000 votes for Bush, clearly grounds to ask for recount. Recount what? There's nothing to recount. Well, there was no record to be recounted.
Well, and that's the point that Kevin Shelley was making, is when you end up with weird-looking numbers, at least if you have a voter-verified paper trail that actually is a ballot, is an actual measurable ballot that can be used for a recount independent of the machine on which the original vote was made, then there actually is some integrity in the machine. I mean, the reality is, Dave, you and I both know, we've been using machines in the United States to vote on since the 1960s. I believe that 1964 was the first election where we used lever machines, mechanical voting machines. I could be wrong. It might have been earlier than that, but I think it was the 64 election was the first time that they were used, in a big way nationally. And, we trusted them. They were fairly transparent. You could see the little gears turning, but, you know, in theory, they could have been manipulated just as easily, and they left no paper trail at all. So this might be an improvement if it's done right, if it's done in a completely transparent way, and in my opinion, if the software is open source. So.
Well, the lever machine was poking hole in a paper that was going to a box. Yes.
No. The lever, no. We're talking about two different things. I'm not talking about punch cards. I'm talking about the actual, I remember back in Michigan in the 60s when I started voting, you walk into a booth and here's a machine and there's a bunch of levers and you pull the lever down for your candidate. It's got his name, you know, on a little piece of paper written up above it. You pull that lever and there's a little counter like an odometer in a car, and that little counter increments one. You just voted for that guy. And there's the little counters running down the side of the machine, and they'd go out there and they'd write them down on a piece of paper and say, here's what this machine said. And it was a machine that was doing the counting.
Oh, wow. And that's how we've ended up with Bushes in the White House and Cheney's and...
Well, and, you know, in fact, the legend of Mayor Daley, which, by the way, would not have changed the election if Jack Kennedy had lost Chicago, he still would have won the presidency, but the Republicans conveniently overlooked that. The legend is that the way that Mayor Daley flipped the election was that in several precincts that were highly Republican, the actual physical voting machines ended up at the bottom of the whatever the river is that runs through Chicago there, the Chicago River or whatever. So, you know, I mean, who knows? But the point is, you know, we have used machines before, and we've had a sense of it, you know, that they're okay. Dave, thanks a lot for the call and the point that you made. Malcolm in Seattle, we have about a half a minute left, Malcolm. What's up?
Okay. You were talking about Osama bin Laden. You think that
he's dead.
Probably dead. He's dead.
He's been dead since 2001.
And yeah, a couple things that be interesting to get your view on. If you remember, just before the 2004 election, there was an Osama video,
right?
That appeared.
Yeah, and there was a lot of speculation that it was phony, and it was. In my opinion. I mean, that October surprise video, which was designed to help George Bush, in my opinion, was a total fake, a total forgery. And that's the only time we've heard from Osama. This guy, and just Google it on the web. You'll find, I mean, there's dozens of, you know, really good sites. The CIA was saying it was a phony. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Take the story of Carpenter Mike and drop his tools and his keys and left and headed out as far as he could.
Hey, welcome back. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I think this is the reason why George W. Bush came out and said...
So I don't know where he is. I just don't spend that much time on him, I'll be honest with you.
Because he's dead. And I just put some links to, you know, the notices of bin Laden's death on our message board. If you want all the details, complete with links to FBI officials saying he's dead, to CIA officials saying he's dead, to Pakistan's president, Musharraf, saying he's dead, just go to TomHartman.com, click on the message blog area, go into the national radio show. I just put the thing up, so it'll be at the very top. It's titled Bin Laden is Dead, and it's pretty unambiguous. You can check it out. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Jay in Arcata, California. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I was just a little put off by Alan Ratner's rant about the gun bill.
You know, why is that?
Well, there's a lot of responsible gun owners in this country, and a lot of them would be Democrats, except the Republicans have truly made that their issue. You know, the Democrats are going to try and take your guns away. In fact, I remember speaking to a close friend saying, hey, why don't you vote Democratic? He said, nope, they'll take my guns away.
But this bill had nothing to do with taking anybody's gun away.
Sure it does. I mean, the idea is that if you sue the gun manufacturer, they can't afford to put guns out of the market. That's the whole point of it.
That's not true. If you sue the gun manufacturers and you're successful, then they're doing something wrong. If a jury of your peers has concluded that any manufacturer, any company, anybody, is guilty of a crime, is guilty of a tort, then of some sort of harm against you, then they've done something wrong.
Tom,
what's wrong with that?
Okay, I'll tell you what's wrong with that. Our jury of our peers awarded, I don't know how many millions of dollars to a woman who was a psychic who claimed that her abilities to predict were ruined by a CAT scan. This is what juries of our peers are doing these days.
First of all, I don't know if that's true or not. I know that if you go to Snopes, you will discover that there is a whole long list of phony arguments like that that cons have been putting out for a long time to support their arguments for tort reform. Secondly, very occasionally those kinds of things do happen, and when they do, they always get reversed on appeal. I mean, we have a system that actually works quite well. Loony stuff doesn't make it through. And so, if gun manufacturers are doing something wrong, why should they not be able to be? Why can't we hold them accountable for it?
Well, I mean, a gun is a lethal weapon by definition.
Sure.
And if you can sue the gun manufacturer, as they've tried to do, to clear the streets of guns. And the point of this legislation,
I don't think that's what people have been trying to. Well, maybe somebody has been trying to sue them for that. They won't succeed then, because that's not going to happen. But what if somebody manufactures a gun that's defective? What if they make a gun that blows up in your hand? What if they make a gun that has some clear danger to it? Why should the gun manufacturers be protected?
I agree with you. They shouldn't be. But Tom, have you ever bought a firearm?
Yes.
Okay, I bought a pistol not too long ago, and the instruction manual, about every third paragraph, says don't point the gun in your face. I mean, there's such ridiculous things on there that were clearly.
Well, it's not that different from buying a toy these days. I mean, you find all these. Flip the visor on your car down, and it says, "Are you wearing your seatbelt?"
Right, and that's why they apparently don't manufacture ladders anymore, because people kept falling off them.
Hey, I just bought a ladder a while ago.
Was it made?
I have no idea, but
my understanding is they're not made in this country because there's too much legal liability.
Oh, that's nonsense.
Check it out. I don't know. I mean, I don't know this nonsense, Tom.
Yeah. See, that's the point. Okay, we'll do a show on tort reform then, because I've got a whole stack of good information on it, and we've done that program before, in my opinion, my take on gun laws by and large, and. I don't know if there's a liberal or progressive position or not. There's Democratic and Republican. Who knows what and all. I agree with Bernie Sanders. It should be up to the states. I live in a very rural state, Vermont, and, pretty much everybody had a gun. And most people were using them for hunting. I'm not a hunter. I'm a vegetarian. I mean, I'm very much not a hunter. And yet, I think that's something that should be up to the state. On the other hand, in Manhattan, you've got a very different environment. And if the
Absolutely.
People of Manhattan want to say, hey, there's no reason for anybody to be walking around the streets of Manhattan with a .22 rifle, that's their right, I think.
Absolutely.
So
the gun control folks don't want to leave it to the states. They don't want to leave it to the cities. They want to just outlaw them.
Yeah, I understand that, and they haven't been successful. But this lawsuit yesterday had nothing to do with that. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with whether or not, the gun industry should be immune from prosecution for torts, for doing wrong. And I don't think, frankly, any industry should be immune from prosecution. We've made immune the nuclear industry. That was a very early, that was when it really first started yesterday. And thanks a lot for the call, Jay. It's a good point that you raise. It's a good starting point. McDonald's here. This is interesting. Yesterday, in the House of Representatives, they voted on the Food Liability Reform Bill. This is a bill making it against the law to sue fast food companies. Representative Rick Keller, Republican of Florida, he's one of the sponsors of the so-called cheeseburger bill. He couldn't show up for the lawsuit, or he couldn't show up for the floor vote. You know why? He was in the hospital to have a loop monitor installed in his chest because of irregular heartbeats related to a recently diagnosed cardiac arrhythmia. Yeah. His spokesman says, I can confirm there are no plans to sue any of the fast food restaurants that he frequently patronizes, but he might stop ordering triple cheeseburgers and start ordering more chicken salads. Very interesting. 1-866-440-TOM. Bill in Eureka, California. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to say thanks for having a forum where you present both sides of an issue. As rarely happens in our news media anymore.
I think it's an important thing to do, Bill. It's occasionally I even get convinced that I'm wrong and I'll change my mind, although it hasn't happened in a year or so.
Fair
Bill,
enough.
Thanks a lot for the call and your kind words. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. And thanks for listening there in Eureka on KGOE. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. When we come back, we've got a delay political death watch alert. It's getting stranger and stranger. What's happening with the hurricane and all sorts of political news? Stick around. Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
You
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the program, my friends. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Here we are, you and me. We've got to get out there and change things. This is just absolutely incredible what's going on here. The House of Representatives, or the Senate rather, yesterday voting down an increase in the minimum wage. I mean, 30 million people working full-time jobs. 67% of all people who live in poverty in the United States are working a full-time job. What's wrong with this picture? I mean, haven't we had this historic notion in the United States that if you play by the rules, if you put in your time, you play by the rules, you do a decent job, that you should at least be able to get to have a reasonable standard of living? No, apparently not. Anyhow, that said, time for the
Delay Political Death Watch.
Yes, the Delay Political Death Watch. It's here. Tom Delay vows this from... There's two parts to this. The first part... from Andy Borowitz. Tom Delay vows to continue fundraising in prison. He will tap into a network of convicted CEOs, Congressman says. Representative Tom Delay, Republican from Texas, said today that even if he is convicted of crimes for which he has been indicted in the state of Texas, he will continue fundraising for future political campaigns while serving time in prison. A defiant Representative Delay told reporters in Washington that being incarcerated would not slow his fundraising efforts one iota, because it would enable him to tap into a cash-rich network of convicted CEOs. If I'm behind bars, he said, you can bet your fanny I'll be reaching out to Dennis Kozlowski, Bernie Ebers, and the rest of my people. I might be able to raise more money in prison than I could on the outside. Specter Representative Delay hitting the fundraising mother load while serving a prison sentence sent shivers through the Democratic Party establishment, while some party leaders openly wondered if there are any Democratic congressmen who could serve time behind bars to level the fundraising playing field. But after a top-level meeting at the DNC last night, DNC Chief Howard Dean was pessimistic that a Democrat could be recruited to break a law or two and follow Mr. Delay through the prison gates. Said Dean, if we Democrats are ever going to be competitive with Republicans in terms of fundraising, we simply are going to have to get better at committing crimes. Yeah. So that's with permission from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Yeah, but in the real news, Tom Delay today arrested, as it were, the old perp walk. Well, you'll read all about it in the news. But Tom Delay showing up in jail, or showing, you know, it's time. Tom Delay has to show. Interestingly, back in 1993, speaking of tort reform for the last hour, speaking of tort reform in the last hour, Tom Delay's 65-year-old father, excuse me, not 93, this was 1988. His 65-year-old father, Charles, was injured in a freak tram accident at the family's home in Canyon Lake, Texas. The injuries left Tom Delay's father in a coma, the doctors advising that he would be basically a vegetable, according to the congressman's aunt, Joanne Delay. After several weeks, his family confronted the dreaded choice so many other Americans have faced to make heroic efforts to let the end come. Tom Delay quietly, and this is a quote from a newspaper story at the time, quietly joined the sad family consensus to let his father die. That from the Los Angeles Times, end quote. And as the Center for American Progress notes, as the last straw of hypocrisy, the Times, Los Angeles Times, detailed how Delay's family later filed suit against two companies responsible for a machine part the company said had failed and thus caused the accident that led to the vegetative state of Delay's father, on whom he pulled the plug. They sued... Tom Delay sued this company for product liability. The case was resolved in 1993 out of court with a payment of $250,000 to Tom DeLay for his dead father's physical pain and suffering and his mother's grief and loss of companionship, among other things. 3 years later, to quote the Los Angeles Times, Tom DeLay co-sponsored a bill specifically designed to override state laws on product liability, such as the one cited in his family's lawsuit, end quote. Yeah, I'm not making this up. I mean, this is, it's, you know, from Terry Schiavo to tort reform. It's like, you know, can you spell hypocrisy? Yeah, I think so. So, Bill O'Reilly out there flogging the we've got weapons of mass destruction we have to worry about story. It's, you know, pushing on that thing out there. We'll have that in a little bit. But it's just, well, here he is.
And you, do you still maintain that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction? Do you still believe that?
No, Bill, I mean, I've been to Iraq several times since the war. I've spoken to lots of intelligence people in America and the UK. Now, I've seen all the reports. I've seen congressional reports, British reports, the ISJ report. But you talk to people in the intelligence community. You talk to people in Baghdad and the government. They have no doubt that before the war, Saddam had active WMD. Now, we're not talking massive stockpiles, but he had them. And because of what he suddenly realized in the fall of 2002 that a war was coming, and so he got rid of the active ingredients.
He did a good job.
Infrastructure.
He did a good job.
He did a very good job. And I just feel that, you know, if people would put more effort into this, you know, we'd get to the truth. Did they go to Syria?
That would turn everything around if they could find out what happened to those WMDs.
There you go. Bill, the guy he had on was a guy named, appropriately named, Con Coughlin. And you can see the clip over at the Think Progress blog, thinkprogress.org blog. Bill O'Reilly trotting this thing out again, the weapons of mass destruction argument. He's still hard at work, you know, pushing the faux news point of view. We got to, you know, back in 2005, you'll recall, after $1 billion was spent looking for weapons of mass destruction, Charles Dolfer comes up with a 92-page addendum to his earlier report, which debunked the claim that Saddam transported his weapons of mass destruction to Syria before the war started. I'm quoting from Payson's filing on Think Progress. The New York Times reported, this is a quote from the New York Times, on Syria, the report said that no information gleaned from questioning Iraqis supported the possibility that weapons were moved out of the country before the invasion, which is one theory about why no unconventional weapons were found. So, you know, Bill O'Reilly, you know, roots around and finds this guy, Con Coughlin, appropriately named, pulls him out, says, here's an author. He's got a new book out about Saddam. And he's the guy. He's the guy. Amazing. I mean, I'm assuming, by the way, that you heard the story about the guy on Brown, Michael Brown of FEMA's staff, who frankly, the only media I saw last night that was reporting this was Keith Olbermann on Hardball, or on a Countdown on his program on MSNBC, about the employee of FEMA, the employee of Michael Brown, who was saying to Brown, people are dying at the Superdome, help, you know, we got a problem here, we need some help here, we need it right away. The guy's name is Marty Bahamonde, FEMA regional director. And he urgent reports, and the reply that he gets back is that he says, sir, I think you know that the situation is past critical. Okay, this was his email to Brown. 3 hours later, Brown's press secretary wrote colleagues to complain that the FEMA director needed more time to eat dinner that evening in a restaurant in Baton Rouge. He needs much more than 20 or 30 minutes, wrote Brown aide Sharon Worthy. We now have traffic to encounter to get to and from the location of his choice, followed by wait service from the restaurant staff, eating, etc. Thank you. This was the head of FEMA's response. Believe it or not, I'm serious. This was the head of FEMA's response to his employee saying, people are dying down here. I mean, here's the actual quote. issues developing at the Superdome. The medical staff at the Dome said they will run out of oxygen in about 2 hours and are looking for alternative oxygen. Everyone is soaked. This is going to get ugly real fast. That's the email he sends. And Michael Brown has his secretary reply saying, sorry, he's got to have time for dinner here before we get back with you. It's, you know, an interesting story, as they say. But, you know, rather than simply complaining about Michael Brown, though, what this is emblematic, not so much of cronyism and corruption, although that's all real, but of what happens when you turn governance, a very important function in a democracy, over to people who do not believe in government. Remember the CEO president we were going to get in Bush? They don't believe in government. How can they govern? 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. Tom Hartman here with you. Time to consider those, you know, things that you thought you knew that you didn't know, that maybe you didn't know, that you did know, that everything you didn't know, that maybe you didn't know, and, you know, it's...
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
And think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. And if one looks throughout the history of our country and other free countries, it is the latter category that tend to be the difficult ones.
Yes, the latter category. And now we're starting to find out about the unknown unknowns as a result of Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He was Colin Powell's chief of staff until last January. This is the guy who was literally the right, well, not literally the right hand man, whatever phrase you want to use. He was Colin Powell's chief of staff until Powell retired from being Secretary of State in January. And he has now spoken out. This is from the Financial Times, the conservative publication in the United Kingdom, sort of the British equivalent of the Wall Street Journal. The Financial Times, the headline, Cheney Cabal Hijacked U.S. Foreign Policy, by Edward Alden in Washington. Vice President Dick Cheney and a handful of others had hijacked the government's foreign policy apparatus, deciding in secret to carry out policies that had left the U.S. weaker and more isolated in the world, the top aide to former Secretary of State Colin Powell claimed on Wednesday. In a scathing attack, I'm still quoting from the Financial Times here, in a scathing attack on the record of President George W. Bush, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, chief of staff to Mr. Powell until last January, said, quote, "What I saw was a cabal between the Vice President of the United States, Richard Cheney, and the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, on critical issues that made decisions that the bureaucracy did not know were being made. Now it is paying the consequences of making those decisions in secret, but far more telling to me is America is paying the consequences." End of quote from the assistant, the chief of staff to Colin Powell. Wilkerson has said such secret decision-making was responsible for mistakes such as the long refusal to engage with North Korea or to back European efforts on Iran. In other words, making the world less safe, making it more likely that there's loose nukes out there. To quote Wilkerson, I would say that we have courted disaster in Iraq, in North Korea, in Iran. Now, this is not some left winger. This is not even a Democrat. This is the Republican assistant to Colin Powell. Quoting from the Financial Times again, a couple of bullet points here. These are the things that he says has made America weaker and more isolated. Among his other charges, by the way, he says that Mr. Powell is now not speaking with him. He says he's not happy with my speaking out because, and I admire this in him, he is the world's most loyal soldier. So Colin Powell, unhappy that his assistant is speaking out, but his assistant is saying it anyway. His charges, to quote the Financial Times, the detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere was a concrete example of the decision-making problem, with the president and other top officials, in effect, giving the green light to soldiers to abuse detainees. As Wilkerson said, you don't have this kind of pervasive attitude out there unless you've condoned it. Condoleezza Rice, this is another one of his charges, Wilkerson's charges. Condoleezza Rice, the former National Security Advisor and now Secretary of State, was part of the problem. Instead of ensuring that Mr. Bush received the best possible advice, she would side with the president to build her intimacy with the president. He further said, the military, particularly the Army and Marine Corps, is overstretched and demoralized. Officers, Mr. Wilkerson claimed, start voting with their feet as they did in Vietnam, and all of a sudden your military begins to unravel. The Financial Times adds, Mr. Wilkerson said former President George Herbert Walker Bush, one of the finest presidents we have ever had, understood how to make foreign policy work. In contrast, he said, his son is not, quoting Wilkerson now, not versed in international relations and not too much interested in them either, end of quote. The Financial Times. Is it going to show up in the New York Times? Is it going to be on CBS News tonight that Colin Powell's number two guy says George W. Bush is running the country into the ditch? Somehow I doubt it. Anyhow, that step one in our Everything You Know is Wrong segment. Step two, Selena Jarvis, the chair of the Social Studies Department at Currituck County High School in North Carolina. This piece Matt Rothschild that wrote for The Progressive said she's not used to having the Secret Service question her or her students. She decided her senior civics and economics class to take photographs to illustrate their rights under the Bill of Rights. One had taken a photo of George Bush out of a magazine and tacked the picture to a wall with a red thumbtack through his head. And he made the thumbs down sign with his own hand next to the president's picture. The Secret Service shows up. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Someone should have told me. Someone should have warned. So I wouldn't have been blinded by the power of that storm. It blew in fast like a hurricane will. I never had a chance and I'm shivering still. Was a shipwreck love.
And welcome back, my
up
friends.
On the rock.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. The shipwreck was called love. Michael Brown. FEMA. Welcome back to our program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Jay, our caller from, I forget what city it was, called earlier about the gun violence. And he sends me a note. He makes the point. He says, a government that doesn't trust its own citizens with firearms is a government that itself should not be trusted. As a Jeffersonian, surely you don't find this a shocking statement, do you? Broadly, no, I don't. However, the purpose of the Second Amendment, and that's where this argument usually goes, the purpose of the Second Amendment, the founders did not put the Second Amendment in the Constitution so that American citizens would always have the ability to rise up and shoot government officials if they wanted to have a revolution. That's not why the Second Amendment is in the Constitution. You go back and read the correspondence, and I wrote, there's a whole chapter about this in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? This all started with Thomas Jefferson saying, in the very, when Madison sent him the draft of the Constitution in 1787, Jefferson was in Paris. He was the U.S. envoy to Paris. Madison was essentially running the Constitutional Convention. He kept the notes for it. He had spent 5 years studying constitutions. He's referred to as the father of the Constitution. Madison was Jefferson's protege. He was his surrogate son, really, in many ways. And Madison helps put together this Constitution. He's very proud of it. And he sends a copy of it to Jefferson, and Jefferson sends him back this letter and says, you know, I really like this, and I really like this. You did a great job here. And he says, but there's one thing. Now I will tell you what I do not like. And he says, you know, what is missing from this is an unambiguous, clear, without the aid of sophistry, a clear and unambiguous Bill of Rights. And then he lists 10 rights that should be in the Bill of Rights. And he says, if you don't put these things in this Constitution, I'm not going to support it. In fact, I'll work against it. And so Madison writes back to him and says, you know, we don't need a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. In fact, if we put a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, because the Constitution itself is a Bill of Rights, the Constitution starts out, the first three words, we the people. The Constitution says, the people have all the rights. That's the whole point of the Constitution. And in fact, if we put a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, future generations may forget that we, the people, hold all the rights, and the government has only privileges, corporations have only privileges, churches have only privileges, that it's we, the people, who have the rights. Future generations may forget, they may think that the rights that we list in the Bill of Rights are the only rights that people are entitled to. And that would be a disaster. And Jefferson writes back to Madison and says, you know, I understand what you're saying, and I share your concern. But there are some things that we have to carve out. And this argument went on between the two of them. And in fact, Alexander Hamilton got into the act in Federalist number 84, as I recall. You can quickly find out on the internet. I'm sure somebody in our chat room will track it down. Federalist number 84, Alexander Hamilton writes, The Constitution is a Bill of Rights. In other words, he's arguing against putting a Bill of Rights in the Constitution because they were trying to get the Constitution ratified in 1787. The Bill of Rights wasn't attached till several years later. So, anyhow, in those 10 rights that Jefferson identified, or those 10 things that he wanted amended to the Constitution, one of them was a ban on commercial monopolies. His phrase was a ban on monopolies in commerce. Quote, unquote. And what he meant was that corporations should not be able to own other corporations. They should not be able to do multiple things. You should incorporate a company to do one thing. It can only do one thing. It shouldn't live longer than an average human being lives so that it, you know, goes through probate. It can't live forever. It can't accumulate wealth forever. That it can't control an industry. That it can't form a monopoly, basically. And Madison writes back and says, you know, the word corporation doesn't exist in the Constitution. We don't even refer to corporations in the Constitution. That's a state matter. And only states can create corporations, and that way, by and large, I mean, there's an exception to that. The Amtrak, for example, is a federally created corporation, but it takes an act of Congress to do that. So basically, only states can create corporations, and therefore, they're closely monitored, so we don't have to worry about that. And Jefferson says, okay, I'll give you that. And then Jefferson's other concern, and this is where the Second Amendment came from, was Jefferson said we must not have a standing army during times of peace. Whenever we're at peace, we have to dissolve the army. Let there be a National Guard. Let there be local civilian militias. Let every American, in fact, or every, he said, every man between the ages of 17 and 47, have a gun in his house and be a member of a militia. This is the model that Switzerland today has. It's one of the reasons why many people suggest why Hitler never invaded Switzerland, because every citizen of Switzerland is a member of the militia. Every able-bodied man in Switzerland is part of the army. So if Switzerland gets invaded, you know, they ring the church bells a certain way. Everybody, you know, opens their closet, grabs their gun, stands out in front of their house, and boom, the whole country is the army. Now, who'd want to invade a country like that? And so this is what Jefferson was arguing. Don't have an army at all, because he was concerned that a standing army would become its own institution. It would gain power. It would threaten democracy. So he wanted there to be no standing armies in time of peace. And Madison agreed with him on this. And John Adams disagreed. And there was this big fight over whether or not they should ban standing armies during times of peace. And that original Amendment, that original Second Amendment, which you can still find in its original language in the early drafts of the Pennsylvania Constitution, and I don't have it in front of me, it's in my book, that says, you know, basically that every citizen, the government shall not bar a citizen from having a gun in order to maintain, because you have to maintain a well-regulated militia so that, you know, we can have an army if we're ever invaded. That language, after it went through a couple of committees, basically, you know, got, you know, sliced and diced and ended up as a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, which is the entire language of the Second Amendment. It used to have a preceding sentence that said, there shall be no army during time of peace, but a well-regulated militia, you know, bloody, bloody, blah. So that's, you know, because if the intent of the founders had been in the Second Amendment to say, we want to make sure everybody, every American has a gun so that if the government ever goes nuts, the good Americans can rise up and overthrow the government. If that's what they meant, if that's what they had in mind, and there probably were a few who thought that way, but if that's what they had in mind with the Second Amendment, it would have said the right of a citizen to own a battleship shall not be abridged, because that was the state of the art of war. The right of a citizen to own a cannon shall not be abridged. And it didn't talk about those things. Because the purpose of the Second Amendment wasn't to give citizens the right to declare revolution against the government. The purpose of the Second Amendment was to eliminate standing armies during times of peace and have basically universal conscription. Everybody is a member of the army. So, you know, Jay, I appreciate your argument and your viewpoint. And by the way, with regard to the ladder manufacturers, Jenny sends me a note. She says, the caller's argument that ladders are not being made in America is absurd. Just look at the American Ladder Institute's website. Lists ladder manufacturers from all around the United States. Thank you, Jenny. Interesting. Yeah. So on it goes. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-TOM. That's also 440-8466. And Charisse in, is it Paulsboro, Washington State?
Yes.
Hey, Charisse.
Hi. Hey, this is a comment about something you were talking about yesterday, about the depleted uranium in the that we use in all of our armor and warheads and everything over in Iraq. I just wanted to let you know that I was reading this article that there are two states now that have passed legislation allocating funds for our returning veterans so that they can have medical services to test for depleted uranium. And it says, and I'm quoting, this test will determine if a soldier has been contaminated. It will prevent misdiagnosis so soldiers are not given wrong medications that usually make them sicker. It will allow the contaminated soldier to decide about parenting further offspring who have an increased chance of serious birth defects. The gal who started this legislation movement was Melissa Sterry in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
She was in the cleanup uranium crew after Gulf One, and she's now very sick, and it says six of her eight team members have died since returning home. All six were less than 35 years old.
Oh, my. Yeah, there is so much of this left over from the first Gulf War, and I have a horrible feeling about what's going to come with the second Gulf War, not
have
to mention what's happening. Pardon?
Have you read about it? There's articles over about it.
Oh, yeah, at length. And I've had several guests on the program talking about it and you know, a physician who's put together one of the groups. Yeah, and I'm pleased to hear that there's, you know, somebody's proposing legislation. Although I'll tell you, with the Republicans in Congress, it's not going to go anywhere.
Well, Louisiana and Connecticut at least are allocating funds to let these poor people be tested.
Oh, these are state bills.
State bills. It's the title of the article, Depleted Uranium, States Take Action to Protect Their Soldiers and Veterans.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks for giving me the heads up on that, Charisse. I'll have to keep an eye out for that. Thank you very much. This is a really big issue, and it's something that we really all should be concerned about. I think it's like Bush, you know, the point I was making earlier about with Michael Brown and FEMA, you can't expect people to govern if they don't believe in government. You also can't expect somebody to run a war if they really don't understand what's involved in warfare. And here you have a bunch of chicken hawks, essentially, people who, during the Vietnam War, to quote Dick Cheney, had other priorities. And the only guy who was a senior administration official, the only member of the administration who really had ever seen what war looks like was Colin Powell, and he was opposed to going into Iraq. You know, his Pottery Barn rules, at least he was very cautious about going into Iraq, let's say. And I think, you know, if his assistant's comments these days are any indication, he's probably feeling very bitter about having been, you know, lied to and then becoming the front man for the lie. But you can't expect people to run a war if they don't know anything about war, too. It's all the more the tragedy. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All that you touch and all that you see, all that you taste, all you feel.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Exposing the con in conservative. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. Tom Hartman with you. In the Democracy Zone. What a novel idea. The Democracy Zone, the free speech of the real free speech zone. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Our telephone number, Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program. Logan? You there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Hey, Logan.
Hey, what's up? I just wanted to say that we live in a great country and we can change our government. We can change these horrible bankruptcy laws. And I just also want to say that
Amen, brother, by the way.
Yeah, thing you said yesterday, you started talking about things that middle-class people can do in this sort of economic climate to make sure that they don't fall into a hole.
Yeah.
You started to talk about, you know, paying off your credit cards and getting a fixed rate mortgage loan.
Yeah, those are probably the two single most important things that people can do right now.
Yeah, and I really think you should be devoting part of your show to those kinds of things, because I think people are kind of lost about how they're supposed to make ends meet and not fall into a hole.
Yeah.
And I think you had some good advice there.
Well, thank you. I'm not doing a financial advice show, and you know, there's folks out there like Dave Ramsey and Clark Howard who do, you know, a great job with those kind of things. And there's a lot of subtle, you know, kind of nuanced stuff, and, you know, where should people invest money and things like that. And I have my opinions on those things, but I may well be wrong, and I could be, you know, I don't present myself as an investment advisor. Although I do think that the economy generally swings between periods of time when it's good to invest in the stock market and times when it's good to invest in commodities, and, you know, like gold, for example, or, you know, physical things. And for the last 4 or 5 years, I think we've been into one of these probably 10-15 year commodity cycles, and I have a feeling the stock market isn't long for this world, at least the current market, and the preceding 15 years were good for the market. But you know, that's that kind of subtle stuff. I mean, that's, I think, beyond the scope of the program. But just those two simple things are those not only represent the greatest danger to America, credit card debt and fixed adjustable rate mortgages and interest only mortgages. They also represent the greatest danger to individual Americans. And so, you know, the extent to which you have credit card debt, pay it off, you know, pay it down to zero immediately as fast as you can. And if you have a mortgage that has any kind of provisions in it that allow the mortgage company to increase the interest rate on it based on the external interest rates, even if you have to pay a fee. Now, I'm not offering financial advice, but what I would do is, even if it cost me an extra fee to refinance that or change that to a fixed rate loan, I would do so as quickly as possible and try and make it as short a loan as possible too. 15-year loans are, you know, vastly underestimated because banks hate to promote them because they're not anywhere near as profitable as 20 or 30-year loans. So
thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Logan. Good to hear from you, George in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, George, listening on KBBR. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I know you are aware of the new Bolshevik Stalinist talking point called the criminalization of politics. I heard it on the Talking Heads this weekend.
Yeah.
And, I mean...
Well, in fact, here it is.
Michael, the criminalization of politics. Mike, go ahead.
I hate the criminalization of politics, but I'm worried there will be indictments.
I tell you what worries a lot of people. That this is a sign of the criminalization of politics.
Yeah, and on it goes. I've got a minute and a half of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I just don't understand how they can be so inoculated against irony and hypocrisy. Because, of course, as Juan Williams said when he grew a set for a second there and actually was speaking out against his Fox News masters, said the
the Republicans were the ones responsible for the criminalization of politics.
Yeah, going after Bill Clinton.
Not the Democrats.
Yeah.
And of course, the Republicans are such a racketeering, influenced, corrupt criminal.
Oh, I see what you mean, yes.
And speaking of which...
That is criminals going into politics, yeah.
Have you talked about Bill Frist's other crime or other outrage, which was many years ago his HCA was, when they were buying up mom-and-pop hospitals and privatizing them, I guess making billions of dollars wasn't enough. He ripped off Medicare for billions of dollars and had to pay an $800 million fine.
Yeah, it wasn't him. It was the company that did. And he wasn't running the company. I believe his brother was. But, yes, I've talked about that many times. And I think it's something. I agree with you, George. It's something that's worth noting. Sally in Sacramento. We only have about a minute left, Sally. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment that I thought about it years ago when we went into war, you know, looking for weapons of mass destruction, whether Iraq had them or it didn't. I always thought that at some point this administration will plant somewhere in Iraq, will plant them and make them look like they found them.
Yeah, I kept expecting that too, frankly, Sal.
I was surprised that they didn't. They are waiting for a pivotal time when they are just so down in the polls, and then suddenly we will find them.
I think that time may have come and gone. You know, they'll find something else. I mean, there'll be some other thing. They'll uncover some plot. There'll be a new terror alert. You know, I mean, Bush, isn't it ironic? Bush gives a speech and saying, be afraid, you know, a terror speech. And then instantly New York has to go on a terror alert, right?
Oh, yeah.
I think they'll find something else.
I don't fall prey of this tactic.
Yeah,
you know,
there you go.
A lot of people do.
Yep.
But anyway, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling, Sally. Great to hear from you. And thank you for listening. Thank you on 1240 Talk City there in Sacramento. Much appreciated. Thanks for being with us, friends, today. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Remember, democracy, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Pass it along.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.